This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. You know those barcodes you see on the side of your cereal box? Well, get ready to see them in a lot of other places, such as the museum or maybe public monuments or even on the front door of your favorite restaurant. You'll be able to use your cell phone to scan those barcodes and get lots of information. David Gorn reports.
San Francisco can be a daunting place. Everyone knows the food can be heavenly, the city can be fun and oh so hip. But how do you know where the cool stuff is? Jonathan Bulkley can tell you how to find out, even though he's across the country in New York.
What our technology does is using the camera on your phone as the navigation device. So you point your camera, and with one click, you go directly to the information that you're looking for.
Jonathan Bulkley is head of a company called ScanBy, which is launching a pilot program in San Francisco. Now, here's where you have to pay attention. The idea is a customer can walk up to a restaurant, for example, that displays a barcode, take a picture of it with a cell phone, and then instantly download a ton of information on that restaurant. Reviews, the menu, the wine list. It's a breakthrough technology, Bulkley says, because it's an entirely different way to navigate the web that completely bypasses using the keypad on a cell phone.
Show people the technology and they just go, wow, when can I use this?
The answer to that is right now. Hundreds of restaurants and businesses across San Francisco are displaying the black and white barcode. This technology has already taken off in Japan, where Bulkley says it's used everywhere. On bus stops, on public monuments, under paintings in museums. Some enterprising young people have printed up T-shirts with personal barcodes on them that link to their MySpace or Facebook pages. As they say, it pays to advertise.
It's a very exciting idea. I love the idea of it. Absolutely love the idea of it.
Julie Osk is a personal technology analyst with Jupiter Research. She says this visual navigation technology could take off over the next 5 to 7 years. Though for the next 3 years or so, she says, there will be a steep learning curve for consumers.
There's a lot of steps between here and what we call mass market. You know, there's a lot of steps and there's a lot of pieces that have to come together for something like this to work.
Only certain types of cell phones with web capability, a high-quality camera, and the downloadable software to access the barcodes can join the system. This particular effort in San Francisco, she says, could falter just because there are too many hurdles in the way of using it. Near Union Square, Ryan Bahadur of San Jose and his friend Darren Bahider of Toronto are looking for a place to eat. They are just the demographic ScanBy wants to capture. Young, tech-savvy, and really hungry.
This place looks tempting, actually.
Bahadur has an iPhone, so he loves the gadgets, but his phone isn't yet compatible with the barcode system. Still, the whole idea strikes a chord with him.
I'd probably try it just because it sounds cool, and I mean, there's a need for that type of information.
But when Bahadur walks down to the barcode outside the restaurant he wants to know about, it's a different story.
Oh, you need software for it. So I don't know if I download the software. That's kind of a drawback.
The makers of ScanBy hope that in the next half year, all new cell phones will come with the software built into them. Until then, some people will download the software and adopt the technology during this pilot run in San Francisco. And once the software is built in, they hope, those little ubiquitous barcodes will become even more a part of our daily lives. For NPR News, I'm David Gorn.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, we meet the unusual chimpanzees of Senegal. Unlike their tree-loving brethren, they live on the ground. Well-grounded chimps, and the man who photographs them, coming up.
First, to the conflict between Tibetans and the Chinese government, a conflict that's also playing out in the online world. A number of American groups that support Tibetans say their groups have been targeted by sophisticated cyber attacks. And as KQED's Rob Schmitz reports, the attacks have increased since the uprising in Tibet began last month, and they are being traced to internet servers in China.
China's crackdown on Tibetans in recent weeks has led to protests from New Delhi to Athens to here along Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Stop the killing!
In Tibet!
Stop the murder!
In Tibet!
Stop
Dozens waved Tibetan flags, screaming in protest on a recent sunny afternoon in front of a federal building in West Los Angeles. But it's not just Tibetans in China who they feel are being unfairly attacked. The demonstrators say China's attacking them, too, with virus-carrying emails.
What's kind of disturbing is that a lot of emails are coming from email addresses of people that I know, but with attachments.
Tsitin Fanucharis works for three local Tibetan advocacy groups.
When we send each other emails, we don't send the attachments. So as soon as you see an attachment, you know that there's something wrong with it. And very often you find out that the person really didn't send it to you. As a matter of fact, this morning I got something from the Office of His Holiness the Dalai Lama with an attachment.
That same email, which appeared to be coming from the personal email of the exiled Tibetan leader, was sent to hundreds who belonged to an electronic mailing list for Tibet supporters. The attachment was infected with the so-called Trojan horse. Other emails shown to NPR, which were described as carrying infected attachments, also appeared to be coming from sources within the pro-Tibetan online community. Greg Walton provides tech support to around 300 Tibetan support groups worldwide. He says since the unrest in Tibet began, anyone affiliated with a pro-Tibetan advocacy group has been receiving around 10 carefully crafted virus-laden emails a day.
There's been a marked upsurge in the level of the attacks, and the attacks themselves have become more sophisticated.
Walton researches Chinese cyber attacks at the University of Sunderland in northern England. He says these recent email attacks aren't packaged in your garden variety spam messages selling Viagra.
The emails which the Trojans are attached to have appeared to come from trusted sources, and the language has been quite nuanced, quite subtle. So the user is led to believe that the email has come from a trusted source and so opens the attachment.
Once the attachment is open, says Walton, the user's computer is under the control of a remote user in another country. Walton has quarantined these viruses to see where they're coming from. Almost all of them, he says, have been traced back to control servers in China. Still, Walton says, it's impossible to know whether they're being launched by Chinese government officials.
If you wanted me to speculate about the source, I would say that it's patriotic hackers who've been tasked by the state to attack these networks.
Walton says if the Chinese government had a direct hand in this, it would have been even more sophisticated in obscuring the source of the attacks. Chen Shijie, a spokesman for the Chinese Consulate General in Los Angeles, said in a statement that the government of China opposes criminal acts undermining computer systems. He said a tiny number of pro-Tibetan U.S.-based NGOs have made groundless accusations against the Chinese government, with the purpose of tarnishing the image of the Chinese government and finding excuses for what he called their anti-China activities.
I'm Yangsen Brown, and this is the Tibet Connection.
Still, the Tibet Connection, a radio program based in Los Angeles, remains suspicious. The program's website and an accompanying blog were recently hacked, says Ronnie Novick. He manages the website out of Dharamsala, India. Novick says the attack prevented news updates from inside Tibet from appearing on it, and it enabled the attacker to see who was visiting the site.
We don't have top secret information or plans or anything, but what we feel that is being looked for is our emails to people inside, messages, Skype messages, instant messages, you know, names and phone numbers. We feel that this virus was put on our site today was looking for visitors from China who were visiting our sites.
Novick says the attack couldn't have come at a more vulnerable time. Correspondents for the program are relaying news on the website from sources witnessing the Chinese crackdown in eastern Tibet. Because the site was hacked, he says, the news didn't appear. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Are listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park.
It's a lab experiment that's been 14 years and $8 billion, that's billion with a B, in the making. It's called the Large Hadron Collider, and it's near Geneva, Switzerland, at a facility called CERN. It's the French acronym for the European Council for Nuclear Research, and it's the largest particle accelerator the world has ever seen. If physicists at CERN have their way, one of the things that it'll be able to do is to create tiny black holes that they can study. But that's exactly what two men are worried about. Walter Wagner and Luis Sancho have filed suit to stop scientists from turning the CERN collider on. Their fear that its operation could unleash a black hole that would basically swallow the entire Earth and all of us along with it. So how realistic is that and how might it happen? Joining us now to explain is David Morgan, physics professor at Eugene Lang College in Manhattan and friend of the BPP. Welcome back, David.
Thanks for having me back.
So first, we're going to wind it all the way back and talk a little bit about fundamentals.
Sure.
Explain to us, what is a particle accelerator?
A particle accelerator is basically a big machine that physicists build in order to smash particles together at really, really high velocities in order to see how they behave and what comes flying out.
And what do you learn from that?
What physicists are trying to learn is something about the nature of the fundamental forces that that govern our universe, forces like the electrical force that holds atoms together, the strong force that holds nuclei together, and figure out how those forces work and how they behave at various energies.
So those are big questions. These machines, particle accelerators, really are at the foundation of some very big
We're probing the fundamental structure of matter.
Let's talk about what these things look like. I actually visited CERN when I was a college student on a field trip, and it was a little bit overwhelming. I remember hearing some kind of vague explanation about what this big machine did, but it is physically large, right, these things?
It is physically large. Basically, the Large Hadron Collider is contained in a tunnel that's 17 miles in circumference. So picture something about the size of a subway tunnel in diameter, and picture a round subway line that's about 17 miles around. So every time the particles go around the accelerator once, they travel about 17 miles.
And just to clarify, CERN, there was already a particle accelerator at CERN.
Mm-hmm.
This is a new one that has just been built.
That's right.
Correct? Now, this new, very large particle accelerator in Switzerland, we talked a little bit about some of the fears surrounding this thing, but why was it necessary? Why are scientists – why did they decide to build this?
What physicists are looking for at the LHC is really physics that's beyond what we call the standard model. In other words, particles and interactions that are – things that we've never before observed in nature, because we've never looked at nature at such a high energy. So the hope among physicists is that we'll see something that we've never seen before, some particle or some interaction or some outcome that's unexpected. And there's a long sort of laundry list of things physicists hope to see. But I think many physicists would be even happier if they saw something they didn't expect at all.
Now, I know there's a long laundry list of things they expect to see, and I know that most of those would require a lot of explanation, but are there a couple examples on that list?
Sure, I can give a couple examples. One is a particle called the Higgs boson, which physicists think is the particle that's responsible for why things have mass. In other words, in particle physics, there's no explanation for why an electron or a proton or anything has this property that we call mass, that it's hard to push it. And the idea is that the Higgs boson is the particle whose interactions essentially give particles mass. There's another set of particles called supersymmetric particles, which are sort of partners to every particle that we normally encounter around us. So an electron has a particle called the selectron, and a quark has a partner called the squark. And these are particles that are postulated for various sort of technical and mathematical reasons that a lot of physicists would like it if they existed, but we've never seen one before in the lab. So
this accelerator can create the circumstances necessary to hopefully observe it.
Which is basically just a lot of energy. Einstein's equation E equals mc squared, if you get enough energy together, you can create particles of matter. And because these particles of matter are more massive than any we've found before, we need a lot of energy in order to make them.
I want to talk about black holes.
Mm-hmm.
There is some speculation that this machine might be used to create small black holes. Now, why would someone want to create a black hole, and how would you even do it?
Well, a black hole is what you get if you take a whole bunch of matter and energy and put it in a very small space. So usually when we think about black holes, we think about astronomy, where a collapsing star can create such a high density that it's so dense that light would be unable to escape from its surface. But I could make anything a black hole if I squished it small enough. I can make you a black hole if I squished you about down to the size of a proton.
You could make me a black hole.
Well, theoretically, it would require we'd have to stick you in the particle accelerator and get you going really fast to smash you down to that size. But the idea is with this particle accelerator, if we smash together two very small particles at a very high velocity, we're packing a huge amount of energy into a very small space, and that could create a teeny tiny little black hole.
If one were to make a black hole on the radio, it might sound a little bit like what we're about to hear. NPR's esteemed science correspondent Robert Krolwich actually did a piece on this back in November 2006 in which he spoke with Professor Brian Greene from Columbia University.
It would, says Brian, be entirely possible to take, for example, an ordinary common watermelon and put it inside some incredibly powerful squeezing machine that's not yet been invented that squeezes so fiercely that the watermelon would become denser and denser and so dense that at some point predicted by Einstein, the watermelon would change states and become a mini black hole.
That's it.
Now, I know we made the sounds up there, but theoretically, this is a real possibility?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In fact, in the next decade, he says, teams of scientists will try to manufacture mini black holes.
And this is not just hypothetical. There's a new machine being built in Geneva, Switzerland right now called the Large Hadron Collider. And one of the things that may happen at the Large Hadron Collider is the creation of microscopic black holes in the collision between protons and protons. These will be tiny black holes, but black holes nonetheless.
Now, that was part of an NPR piece from November 2006. Fast forward to today, and physicists are about ready to take that Large Hadron Collider in Geneva for a spin. They're about ready to start using this. And as we said before, there are some people out there who are concerned that this machine could create a mini black hole, which could basically suck us all into oblivion. How realistic is that, David?
I don't think it's very realistic at all, for a couple of reasons. One of which is the black holes that would be created are very, very tiny, which means they have a very, very small mass. Now, one of the misconceptions about black holes is that they're these sort of magical sucking machines, that once you make a black hole, it just sucks everything around. A black hole just has a gravitational pull, like everything in the universe has a gravitational pull. So, for example, if I were to squish you down to a black hole right now, I wouldn't go flying across the studio and stick to you because you still have the same mass that you had before. The gravitational pull is the same. So, yes, the Large Hadron Collider could make a teeny tiny little black hole. But the energy of this black hole would be about the same mass energy as a mosquito. And it has no more danger of this little black hole sucking up the Earth than a mosquito is in danger of sucking up the entire Earth with its gravitational pull.
So let's talk specifically about the lawsuit then. How much merit does this suit have, and what are the arguments being put forth?
I think it has very little. First of all, it should be noted that this same individual put out forward a similar lawsuit to keep them from turning on the relativistic heavy ion collider, which is out on Long Island and has been running for years. And last time I checked, Long Island was still there.
So this is someone who has some fear.
Yeah. And the other thing is, while the Large Hadron Collider is going to create the sort of highest man-made energies ever created in a particle accelerator, it is certainly not the most energetic thing in nature, the most energetic thing to happen on the Earth. Our planet is bombarded by cosmic rays from space every day that are billions of times more powerful than the Large Hadron Collider. So if there's any danger of a micro black hole being created to devour the Earth, it would have happened up in the top of our atmosphere sometime within the last 4 to 5 billion years.
You're not afraid. You're not living in fear.
I won't be losing any sleep over it.
David Morgan, physics professor at Eugene Lang College in Manhattan. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Hold on there, whippersnappers. This black hole business isn't over yet. We want to get back to that piece by NPR's esteemed science correspondent Robert Krolwich that we just excerpted because it helps to explain one reason why the scientists in Geneva might be interested in creating tiny black holes. The conversation between Krolwich and physics professor Brian Greene was actually about efforts to create a man-made universe. We've already heard that scientists are close to creating microscopic black holes. Get out your pens and take notes, as Mr. Krolwich and Greene explain the next step in creating a man-made universe is to take a tiny black hole and expand it. Do tell.
It then explodes, roughly speaking.
Now, this is the universe I was waiting for. So how do you do this? Obviously, you've inserted something or you've changed something to alter the physics of the little black hole, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that physics has to do with a strange feature of gravity that none of us have ever experienced, but the math shows us is true, and observations of space seem to confirm, and that is that gravity can actually be not only attractive, it can not only pull things together, it can also be repulsive. It can push things apart.
And this force exists in nature?
The repulsive side, there's actually direct observational support for.
So it is there, and if you can learn to release this repulsive force, theoretically, you could hit a ball into the air, and instead of coming back down to Earth, instead the space between the ball and the Earth would suddenly be filled with repulsive energy, pushing out like two sharp elbows, pushing the ball further and further and further away from Earth as the space between gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So this force, what it does, is it creates space. So much space that it can turn a little black hole into a universe.
Because the repulsive side of gravity is so powerful that it actually injects energy from gravity itself into the expanding space. So from that point of view, all you need is the seed, and then gravity takes over and does the rest of the work.
And right now there are scientists at Ben-Gurion University in Israel, Yamagata University in Japan, Stanford University in California, who are trying to manufacture first a seed, a mini black hole, and into that seed one day they hope to place a trigger to release this repulsive force and so create, unbelievable as it may seem, the first man-made universe.
So I don't want to hear anyone complaining about not learning anything from the news ever again. That was NPR's esteemed science correspondent, Robert Krulwit.
Western Union is expanding a program aimed at immigrants in the United States who want to use their cell phones to send money overseas. The company is taking advantage of the growing use of mobile phones throughout the developing world. NPR's Laura Seidel has this report.
Immigrants often come to the U.S. to help make money to support families back home. One of the most common ways of sending money back is to walk into a Western Union, put money on the counter, and have the cash wired to another branch outside the U.S. Now that some 3 billion people around the world have cell phones, Western Union sees an opportunity, says Matt Dill, general manager of Western Union Mobile.
The ability to move money from one handset to another to essentially give somebody value to top up a phone or pay a bill locally is really kind of the next step in moving money.
Outside the United States, using mobile phones to pay bills and do banking is much more common. It hasn't caught on in the U.S. because we have so many other options like online banking and ATMs. But immigrants don't like to use banks, and many don't have computers. Western Union has partnered with a small wireless provider, Trumpet Mobile, and with Radio Shack, which will sell phones with the new application. On the phone, users pull down a menu, click on Send Money, put in an ID number, and the money will arrive on a relative's phone. Last year, Western Union reports it moved $64 billion to 200 countries across the globe. Dill of Western Union says the company must adapt to new technologies.
We're a remittance company, and the ability to accommodate and expand and extend into new technologies is really core to our strategy.
Western Union has already been running a pilot program using the new system, but it is now expanding it to more than 4,000 Radio Shacks around the country. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
It is April Fool's Day, and you're probably going to get Rickrolled if you haven't been already, Rachel Martin. For those of you who haven't experienced it yet, okay, you're reading an email from your friend, and he's telling you he found something really hilarious, like maybe a picture of Amy Winehouse falling down some stairs. And so you go ahead and you click on the link, and then...
Your heart's been aching, but you're too shy to say it. Inside we both know what's been going on. We know the game and we're gonna play it. And if you ask me how I'm feeling...
Yeah, get out your trench coat, your double-breasted blue blazer, your uncomfortably high chino pants. You've been Rickrolled. That song was a number one hit worldwide 20 years ago when that howdy-doody-faced Rick Astley, he's a big star back when Aiken and Zonde were just in preschool. Rick Rolling, really can't explain it, it just is. It's just the widest reaching internet prank out there right now. It is harmless and hilarious. It's not the only one. But before there was Rick Rolling, there was Duck Rolling. Before that, there was Goatsy, which is
Disgusting. Here to talk about all this internet mischief is Tim Huang. He's a Harvard student organizing RaffleCon, an internet humor convention, later on this month. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great. Let's start with Rick Rolling. You're the internet humor expert. What is so effective about Rick Rolling?
I don't know. I think it's because, Well, Rick Astley is kind of this sort of pop culture zombie, right? He had this song in the late 80s, and it was really popular, and then he just kind of disappeared, and no one kind of heard anything from him since. And then, you know, now we're talking about a decade later, you're trying to get to an important document online or something, and you just see this guy doing crazy dance and doing backflips and stuff.
When was the first time you were Rickrolled?
Oh, I got Rickrolled probably about a year or so ago. I was just trying to get to something, and my friend sent me a link, and it was Rick Astley. And I don't know, it's weird because I actually didn't know about the joke to begin with, so I assumed he had just made a mistake. And I think he Rickrolled me two or three times after that.
Everyone remembers their first time, Tim.
What was going on? Yeah, everybody remembers their first time.
I know this is a little bit of a difficult question, sort of a philosophical question, but what's so funny?
I don't know. I think it's just sort of the expectation of it. What's really funny is, though, that sort of a lot of kids that Rickroll now don't have any memory of sort of Rick Astley back in the day. And so I think it's great that just millions of kids are using this. And that's partially what's so funny about it.
Now, this game of somebody giving a fake link, it has some precedent. There was Duck Rolling, where you ended up on a non-sequitur link of a duck just on wheels.
Right.
And then there was the Goatsy, which for decency's sake will say you were taken to a shocking image of a human body part. All right, we talked about what made Rick Rolling so funny. The other one's just kind of disturbing, don't you think?
Yeah, I think disturbing is probably the right word for it. I mean, well, with Goatsy, I guess it's part of it's sort of the spectacle of the thing, right? You really want to be there when the person is seeing it. To the extent that there's all these sites online of sort of people taking pictures of their friends and showing them Goatsy.
And then posting those pictures online so that everybody can see their embarrassment?
It's like thousands and thousands of people looking really shocked or disgusted. It's really great.
I like the way you add, and it's really great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But with Rickrolling, it's kind of this sort of private shame, right? You're sitting alone in your room, and you realize that you can't get to anything because all of the links are Rick Astley doing his dance.
It's only shameful if you know all the words and you sing along.
And you do the little dance along with it.
Like, well, people really get into it. You know, Rick Astley is kind of this nerd anthem that's sort of come out of nowhere in the last few months.
Can I do anything to prevent being Rickrolled? Are there any telltale signs?
It's tough. Sometimes you just got to judge it. I mean, there's a lot of links. You just got to be aware of what looks important. Hmm. But it's tough, too, because it might just actually be important and just be in big trouble.
Right. We're talking to Tim Huang. He's a Harvard student organizing RaffleCon, as in Roll on the Floor, LaughingCon, an internet humor convention later this month. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. But there are different ways to raise trouble on the internet, and some are a little more political than others. There was this decoding of a certain kind of encryption that made its way around. Tell us what happened with Blu-ray.
Sure, definitely. So there was a group of hackers actually who uncovered the encryption code for Blu-ray discs, that's sort of the high-definition video that came out recently. And they started an online campaign to sort of publicize this code. So they had people post it everywhere on dig.com and everything. So for a 48-hour period, everything on dig.com and reddit.com and sort of all these other news sites were all just this code over and over and over again. But I mean, the funny thing is that people who got involved, sometimes they didn't even know what the code was all about. They just thought it was really funny that they would be able to sort of swamp these news sites. So I don't know. I think it's really interesting because we're starting to see, I don't know, Surowiecki has this term, the wisdom of crowds. But I think we're kind of seeing the sort of exuberance of crowds where, you know, people might not even know what they're getting themselves involved in, but they just kind of like the momentum of it all.
And quite often now, these pranks, they're not just staying on the interwebs. They're translating into terrestrial shenanigans, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this thing is getting bigger and bigger. I think the next few years are going to just see it really explode. In England, for example, there's a practice now of coordinating through the internet a series of zombie walks where hundreds and hundreds of people will dress up like zombies, and they'll just show up on street corners everywhere, you know, thirsting for brains and whatnot. And another group in New York, Improv Everywhere, has done a number of awesome projects. My favorite one is they got hundreds of people to descend on a Best Buy in employee uniforms and ask people for help. And the entire store was just filled with hundreds and hundreds of Best Buy employee lookalikes. And they'd actually sent the police in, but they couldn't figure out who is who. So I think it's definitely a growing phenomenon.
Yeah, we had one of the guys from Improv Anywhere on here when they had go on the subway without your pants on day.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about RaffleCon. What's going to happen there?
Sure. So RaffleCon was inspired by sort of these projects. We got to thinking, so it's interesting that the Internet's kind of manifesting itself now. So we got to thinking, what would happen if we brought, you know, the entire Internet to one place for one or 2 days? And so we've been going through the process of trying to get all these various Internet celebrities and people behind various Internet pranks to come. And it's just gotten bigger and bigger. So it's going to be in a few weeks, actually, April 25th and 26th.
And I'm checking out your guest list. Well done.
Oh, thank you.
Tell people who are coming.
Yeah, a lot
some of the bigger names.
We're excited about. I mean, we have the people who created Homestar Runner, Brad Neely, who did a number of cartoons that were really, really popular online. Dinosaur Comics, it's also another sort of famous webcomic, and even sort of some other Internet meme people like Tron Guy and Leroy Jenkins.
Guys from Jib Jab, the guys from Stuff White People Like.
Yeah, he's actually going to be giving a talk about Stuff White People Like.
Rocket Boom, Chuck Norris Facts. Looks like it's going to be a pretty good event.
Yeah, it should be a great time. We're definitely looking forward to it.
All right, is it okay if we send one of our guys up there to crash?
Oh, definitely.
All right, Tim Huang is organizing RaffleCon next month in Cambridge. Actually, this month now we're in April. It's April
Hello.
1st in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tim, we thank you for your wisdom.
Thank you.
For your Astley knowledge, your vast Astley knowledge.
Astley with a T. Next on the show, it's New Music Tuesday. Friend of the BPP, Lizzie Goodman from Blender Magazine, is here.
Hi, Lizzie.
She's over there. We see her through the glass. We're going to talk about new releases from Kylie Minogue and R.E.M. Very exciting. You know, my initials are R.E.M.
It's true.
Ellen? Elizabeth.
Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. There you have it. Don't go anywhere. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Rick Astley.
Day when cell phone makers show off their latest innovations. They're attending a convention in Las Vegas, and they're offering their latest devices, phones that surf the internet and do much more, and in some cases claim to do all that without making you press a button. On the occasion of this conference, the inventor of the cell phone is talking about his offspring. 35 years ago, Martin Cooper came up with a device that has transformed communication. He tells the Reuters news service that people thought he was, quote, crazy to talk about phones in people's pockets. But Cooper's dreams were actually bigger. And he's a little disappointed that we haven't made more progress. He was hoping that one day all phones would be wireless. And he also expected that people would someday have devices embedded in their bodies. That may not have happened yet, though many people do have them all but attached to their ears.